All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Well, hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective. And tonight is going to be a little bit of an interesting one because I broke some equipment and Robert is not where he's able to normally record. So we're going to be using some different stuff, different styles of gear here. And Robert is going to have some significant delay in his replies. Hopefully that won't be too much of a bother. And I will try to edit some of that out in the audio feed that you can find at actualanarchy.com. And we will be talking about Newsies tonight. This is a recommendation by our guest who we'll introduce in just a moment, but that's why I'm wearing the funny hat. And she has one as well. So that should be really, really good for the video viewers here. But anyway, you can find the show notes more at actualanarchy.com/251. And that will be where the show notes and more for this episode on Newsies. And Robert, if you can gear up to a reply, how are you doing over there in no man's land?
Daniel, I don't think it looks funny at all. I think you look good. I think the style that was around the turn of the century, around the early 1900s, was actually pretty damn cool. Like this, that merged into like the flapper style of the 20s. It's all some very cool styles that could easily be milked for modern stuff that would look really nice. This is back in the day, of course, when people had like one or two good outfits that they would wear all the time, but they looked good. Like that vest look style with the nice dress shirt and the slacks. I think that's a strong look. And then you got the nice cool hat on. I think it could stand a comeback.
All right. Yeah. I think I agree with you, and very good having a steamroll of content to say so that your contributions seem more full than they otherwise might, because there is going to be a significant delay. You won't be able to butt in very well, and I won't be able to direct too many questions your way, but we do have our milestones. Like, you'll kick off with your opening salvo. You know how we're going to do the how many papes we're going to rate this thing at the end. And so I think this is going to work out just fine. So anyway, people can find us at actualanarchy.com/251, and we're going to get into the last narrative portion of the show, introduce our wonderful guest right after this. Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood and Robert Paul Johnson. We are the Last Nighters. You can find us at lastnighters.com and also on the Liberty Movement's YouTube channel. We're going to be talking about Newsies tonight, and this should be a fun one. You can find the show notes and more at lastnighters.com/194. And this is a more family-friendly movie than the one we did last week with the great Pete Quinones of the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast, where we talked about the James Woods, Oliver Stone movie, Salvador, which was pretty intense. This one, though more family-friendly, I think we're going to have a fairly contentious ripping apart of some of the stuff in this movie. But our guest, already in the pre-show bonus content, let me know that she actually saw some positives in this that I think most people would be abhorred by. But that's what we do here, of course. So find the show notes and more at lastnighters.com/194. And if you want pre-show bonus content, go to lastnighters.com/Patreon, send some money our way, and we will give you access to the free pre-show and the post-show, which we call Kathleen Turner Overdrive. And without much further ado, let's introduce our guest. She is Abby, and she is a contributor at the Bad Roman Project. You can go to thebadroman.com. She also was a student and an assistant for Dennis Foster, who has been a guest of ours many times in the past, most recently for Total Recall. And I think that's how you heard of us, by listening to an episode that he did with us. And it sounds like you have seen a few of our episodes, and I appreciate you reaching out and wanting to come on and do a show with us. So thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Actually, I had listened to the show for like years and heard him on an episode and was like, hey, I know that guy.
Oh, wow. Okay. So I thought it was because of your relationship with Dennis that you came by hearing about us, but no, so it's totally like a serendipitous coincidental thing.
Not a and I messaged thing. Him on Facebook and was like, oh my gosh, I just heard you on a podcast.
All right. Well, that's cool. Well, hey, why don't you tell us a little bit about the project that you contribute to at the Bad Roman and maybe why you suggested this movie for tonight before we get into the discussion.
All right. So the Bad Roman Project has to do with examining the relationship between Christians and the state. So basically, like, why Christians worship the state instead of God, like they're kind of supposed to. So it's Craig Hargis runs the podcast, and he just has different guests on all the time. I've written a bunch of articles and done a bunch of episodes with him. We kind of talk to anybody who wants to come on. The most recent episode I was on, we talked to a couple of atheists actually about kind of what the kind of evangelical involvement with the right wing politics, like how that makes Christians come across. We talk about all kinds of stuff over there. And I chose this movie because, first of all, I feel like women of my age, who this movie came out when I was in elementary school, and we would watch it at all the sleepovers, so there's that high nostalgia factor. But also I thought, you know, it for a kids movie, it really deals with a lot of interesting issues, like unions obviously, and child labor, and things like the powerful rich evil guy and the poor little people. And I just thought it had a lot of good stuff that we could talk about. And the songs are great. And I love musical theater. So.
All right. Well, this is, of course, one of Robert's least liked genres. That is musicals, of course. We've done a couple musicals in the past, and he always has a few gripes about it. So I'm sure he'll get a good rant in here on your movie selection when he gets going. And how we start off is with the old Google description. I'm going to bring that up on the screen here, and we will get underway. Just let me turn off your banner. So that's thebadroman.com. That's where people can find that. If you're watching the video, you can see that scrolling across the bottom. Until now, just turned it off, and we will get underway with Newsies, which came out in 1992, has a 6.9 out of 10 on IMDb, 39% Rotten Tomatoes, 4.6 out of 5 on Vudu, and 81% of Google users like it. The description reads, in this musical, homeless New York City newsboy Jack Cowboy Kelly, played by a young Christian Bale, befriends two newcomers to his trade, brothers David, played by David Moscow, and Les Jacobs, Luke Edwards, when publisher Joseph Pulitzer, played by Robert Duvall, sets new rules that make it harder for the young newspaper salesman to make a buck. The boys go on strike. Brian Denton, played by Bill Pullman, is a journalist who's sympathetic to their plight and gives them some tips in public relations as the newsboys' battle grips the city. Came out April 10th, 1992, directed and choreographed by Kenny Ortega, set in New York City, and has a box office of $2.8 million against a budget of $15 million. And Robert, I'm going to go to you for your opening salvo, so you may begin enunciating now.
Very good, Daniel. Thank you for that lovely introduction. And this movie, you know, as you said, this is probably my least favorite genre. And this movie starts off making the worst possible impression. I was reminded of Les Miserables, where it just starts off with singing and then it just doesn't stop. And I was just like, oh no. Okay. This movie can just be safely ignored. Like the entire movie. Cause anytime they're singing, it doesn't really advance the plot. It's just singing for the sake of expressing some emotion about how the characters are happy about what just happened or why they're upset about what just happened or what they're about to do. It's never really plot oriented, so you can just safely just ignore it and or turn away and do something else, something productive, instead of pay attention to the stupid thing. And this movie, it starts off with this, I mean, talk about putting your worst foot forward, this gnarled, gouty, pus-filled foot, and just sticks it right out there with the most incomprehensible song that I couldn't even understand what they were talking about. Like, they were kind of sort of semi, you could kind of like, you can make out a word here and there, but you basically got the point that, okay, they're newsies and they're all about selling papes or whatever, and they're dancing and singing. Okay. Then the movie gets into good stuff for the most part. I mean, not good stuff, but like you guys alluded to, it is accidentally comedic, where the newsies, at one point, the main plot point in the film, and it's all based on a true story, supposedly. And I suppose the only true story was that Pulitzer raised the prices of the paper and there was a strike in response. Everything else is completely fictional. But, and I suppose maybe like the principal character, maybe he's a real human being. But the idea that the newsies have their rights trampled on by somebody raising the price of a product they're selling is hilarious. Imagine if anytime you went to a store and the price of something had gone up, you pitched a hissy fit and said, wait a minute, my rights have been trampled on. My consumer rights. I have some right that is set at some arbitrary price point. The price of gum went up from 25 cents to 30 cents. I have a right to be able to buy gum at 25 cents. You have destroyed my rights, store owner. It's hilarious. There doesn't seem to be any kind of contractual situation with the little newsy guys. So there is no situation where there is any rights being trampled upon. There was no breach of contract of any kind. The newsies at no point go to a lawyer and they're like, hey, we had this agreement that we could buy these papers at 2 for a penny and now we can't. So it's quite hilarious that they have this problem, and then they think that they are owed, you know, a cheaper newspaper. I mean, I get it that, you know, they don't, maybe there's a price point, there's a price, a selling price on the paper itself, and the newsies don't want to just go around and start charging what, like a penny. You can't charge like a penny and a half or a penny and a point or whatever. So you gotta charge it a penny and eat the cost there. But you're still an entrepreneur and you are taking a risk and you are voluntarily purchasing that paper at the increased price, understanding that you're probably only going to be able to sell it for the original price you've been used to selling it for. So the man, Pulitzer's man, says, oh no, we shouldn't do this. You know, all the newsies are just going to go flock to Hearst. But then Pulitzer kind of like has a buddy-buddy back alley slap, you know, poker game with Hearst and their buddies. And Hearst, off camera, apparently agrees to do the same thing. Otherwise, there would be competition. So there is a fair bit of collusion involved. Not that I'm necessarily against that either. But I wish the movie, because they really do a good job, or they make a real commitment to make Pulitzer out to be a bad guy. And they do make a good job of showing how the news is really just a story that they're telling and how it changes like a game of telephone, and how they are selling up all the lavacious, you know, language in order to try and sell papers. Who cares what the actual truth is? So I wish that the story, the Pulitzer was more of a villain based on his, you know, disregard for the truth and his push of, you know, his whatever politics are or whatever he's trying to get done or accomplished. The movie itself is, you know, hot garbage from my perspective. At least it does have dialogue. It does have spoken dialogue. The romance feels super tacked on. The only decent actor is Bale, but it's good that they put him in the lead for the most part. His counterpart, the smart kid, cannot act. Lone Star
is decent, but doesn't do a whole lot. Roosevelt, the war himself on the granite wall of shame, is somehow a hero in this trash movie. But overall, you know, there's a lot to talk about. And I know I'm just kind of ranting because I can't really interject and talk like a real conversation here. Yeah, that's my general view on this thing. There were no good standout songs. They were all forgettable. The choreographic stuff was bad. But I overall, it had a fair amount of charm, and I did like the subject matter. The setting and the subject matter, I think, are this movie's strongest parts. And Bale's performance is pretty decent. And that's about it. Unfortunately, it's a musical, so it's going to get a negative recommendation for me. You'll have to stay tuned to see what I think of how many papers out of 10 this dumpster fire gets.
All right. Very good, Robert. And just the folks at home who are listening, just know that Robert is going to be doing some over and out and 10-4 good buddies like he's talking on a walkie-talkie, because there's about a 5 or 10 second delay on when he hears us and then when he can speak. So it's going to be a little bit different. We're going to need to wind him up and then release him into a tirade a few times in this episode. So just some initial feedback, and then we'll go to Abby. I think that I agree with you that it does start out as not very promising, and it does seem like that they're just going to be singing musical numbers throughout this entire thing. Fortunately, they kind of slow down with that and get a little bit into the meat of it. I do agree that while raising the price of the product that they're selling, including maybe, I don't know, somewhat in bad faith, but there's no guarantee in anything. And the fact that they're unhappy about it doesn't mean that their rights are being trampled. There are plenty of opportunities for other things to do. They could have gone to Hearst. They could have gone to the New York Post. They could have gone to anyone else or started their own newspaper, which is another thing that I want to get into, because they actually steal paper and materials and use of the press that Pulitzer owns in order to make their competing paper to get their gripes out, so they can pamphleteer out into the neighborhoods and whatnot. But Abby, let's go to you for your feedback on the Google description and Robert's mini tirade there, and then we'll try to address a question to him to get him wound up once more.
All right. Yeah. So I was actually surprised that he had a couple good things to say in there. I was really definitely expecting the tirade. Yeah, good Google description. I think I just would add, because since we were going to talk about this, did the research on the true story. So what actually happened was, during the Spanish-American War, the price of the papers for the Newsies went up. And so this was after the war ended, and the Newsies wanted the price to come back down. And so that was what the strike was actually over. I think, like, There were two main guys, but they weren't like the same main guys. And then there was kind of a controversy about they were wearing nicer clothes, and suddenly the strike wasn't going as well. How it ends up, though, is they don't get the price lowered, but the newspapers agree to buy back the papers that they can't sell. So that was the compromise. Also, Teddy Roosevelt was not involved whatsoever. So I think it's interesting that they introduced him in this movie. And I guess because they were working so hard to make Pulitzer the villain, and I think he kind of had used his paper against Teddy Roosevelt because he was a Democrat and Roosevelt was Republican. So I don't know. I think that's where it came from and why Teddy Roosevelt was the hero of the movie. But I agree, that's like the absolute worst part. Like, why does he even show up? It makes no sense. And a total bummer that they try to make him into the hero.
Yeah. And Roosevelt was known as a trust buster, right? Even though he's kind of like a crazy person. I don't know if you've heard some of the Rothbard lectures, but he talks about how Teddy Roosevelt was just all over the map and total nonsense. I'll post a link to that one. It's about Rothbard talking about the progressive era, I think. He also talks about the lone nut theory, about assassinations of presidents in that one. So it's a pretty interesting talk. Rothbard's got some really great stuff. But it does seem weird, because I guess a trust buster would be seen as a pro-union guy. So maybe that's why they were making him the hero in this, because it seemed as if in the story, they're like, oh, well, if only Roosevelt became aware of this exploitative practice of Pulitzer, this greedy capitalist, and this crony relationship with the boys' home, the juvenile prison that they had, which was sort of this self-reinforcing mechanism. Like, you get these kids in trouble and then they have to work for Pulitzer, and you sort of get this little cycle going on.
Well, they couldn't work when they were in the, what do they call it? The refuge. They were like legit in prison and couldn't work there anymore. But he does talk about the more kids that can get caught up in there, that the whoever the guy is who's the head of the refuge gets to like pocket the extra money, that the more kids that are in there, the more money he gets from the state and the more money he gets to pocket. And they also mention in the court scene, I think Jack kind of suggests it, that they don't really say that's what's happening, but suggests that he's giving kickbacks to the judge when the judge is sending kids to the refuge too.
Right. And this is, of course, the common vice article trope that you'll see about private prisons, and how there's this crony relationship between the judge and the private prison that's making more money by having more prisoners, and then they pay off the judges. And of course, this happens from time to time, but it's only private, really, in name only. It's almost a fascistic relationship where it's still the state putting somebody into this system, and it just so happens to nominally be owned by private investors or a private corporation, who of course would benefit from having more prisoners. And so that's the incentive structure that's put into place. But by no means is it a free market system that they try to portray it to be. Whenever the discussion of privatizing anything gets brought up, you get thrown back at your face. Oh, privatizing prisons is a for-profit venture. It makes it really terrible.
Yep.
All right. It was weird to get a delay from you, but I think it's just because I didn't direct the question to you. So I wanted to talk briefly about Bale's performance. So my wife and I were watching this, and she paused it for a minute. She's like, wait, is that Christian Bale? And I'm like, yes, but it is so long ago. This must be one of his early performances. And he does look, you know, you could tell it's Christian Bale, but he does look a fair amount different. And he also stands out, like, amongst all of the other players, the other actors that we see in this film, even Vinny, the friend of Doogie Howser.
Yeah.
You can definitely see that Bale has this it factor, and you can see why he's like the star of the show and why he went on to do some really compelling work later on, especially in Dark Knight, the Christopher Nolan trilogy. And he's also great in The Machinist and The Prestige and a few others. So I'm a bit of a Christian Bale fan, especially his rants. When he gets mad at lighting guys for like fucking up a scene, and he goes off on them. You don't see me walking into your lighting rig and fucking up your occupation.
Yeah. I try to convince my kids to watch this movie with me by telling them Batman is in it, but they don't fall for it.
Oh, okay. Now, okay. This is a question then. I saw this when you recommended it. I was like, oh, hey, honey, talking to my wife, like, we're going to be doing Newsies next week. So maybe it's a movie we could watch with the kids, like we did with The Croods from a few weeks ago. But after watching this, I'm like, there's no way that I want my kids to see this movie, because it is so propagandistic in this pro-union, you know, like they're claiming that they're being exploited by this evil capitalist guy. Yet they're the ones initiating violence against people who are willing to still do the work at the rate and whatever the price of the papes is. That the new price is like they're calling him scabs, and I forget what the term that they used other than, hey, let's go beat the shit out of him.
Soak him.
Yeah.
Soak him for Cratchy.
Right. Yeah. So it's like they use this cute little term to kind of twist the language and make it less accurate, you know? So it's like calling theft taxation or murder. We'll call it war. And then all of a sudden it's okay.
Right.
You know, it's one of those little word games that kind of gets played. So saying that they're going to soak them when it means they're going to go beat the shit out of them for doing something that they, by any right, should be able to do. They're the ones willing to go and buy 50 or 100 papes at the new price, which was like a 10% increase.
Yeah.
Right. So it's not even like, I mean, the principle at play shouldn't matter what the new price is. Competitive pressures will mitigate that to a large degree, but it is a really minor change, and to think that their rights are being trampled and need to unionize and commit violent acts against other people. And then, of course, they are presented as the victims when the newspaper guys hire people to protect their establishment, because the newsies are there causing mayhem, destroying materials, destroying property, committing violent acts against people still willing to do the job. And they also make the police out to be the villains for ignoring the plight of the poor newsboys who are initiating the violence. It's totally backwards.
Yeah. I did think it was interesting, though, because they do have conflict over that, of Davey trying to get them to stop being violent, that that's not right. And that not necessarily that it's not a moral thing to do, but that it doesn't bode well for their public image when they're trying to get people on their side. And that was another thing when I looked up the history of the real story, that that was a real issue that they dealt with, that at first they were beating up the scabs, and but they realized that they needed to get the public on their side, and did end up stop being violent. And there was so much sympathy for them, for these like poor orphan kids, that people just stopped buying the newspapers, even from the people who were willing to sell them or the shops or whatever, because they were on the side of the newsies getting their discount back.
Okay. So it becomes like a bit of a PR thing. I wonder if in present time we could consider the summer of 2020 and all the mostly peaceful riots. Now, in that respect, and this is another angle that we sort of see in this film, in that Pulitzer said that he was using his power with journalism or media to control people's opinions, mold their opinions and their politics. And it reminds me of the network scene where he says that you've messed with forces of nature you don't understand, or something like that, when he's talking to Mr. Beale. Is that his name? I haven't seen Network in a while, but you must atone. We will be doing that one at some point. We were going to do it with James Gentiman, but we did The Birdcage instead a few weeks ago for the back end of Pride Month, actually. But what the fuck was my point? My point is that he's realizing that his power to mold opinions is one that I think actually does make him a bit evil for. And we see that in how the opinions of the mostly peaceful protests. Now, it's, of course, a meme because the mainstream media attempted to mold the opinion that people would have of violent acts and property destruction as being legitimate grievances or benign, or, oh, it's insured, don't worry about it, or whatever. But so they take the most charitable interpretation of all of these things that you can't ignore, like they're happening. Meanwhile, if there's anything on the opposing side, they demonize it, villainize it as much as possible, like the Kyle Rittenhouse situation, who, to my eye, clearly seemed to be defending himself from multiple attempts at murdering him. And of course, they make him out to be there looking for violence or being a white supremacist or something along those lines, which is, of course, based on the evidence that we see, a total distortion of the facts. But yet they continue to do it. So the press certainly does have a significant amount of power in trying to mold opinions in the political climate and in the culture.
Yeah, for sure. And I think Pulitzer actually ended up becoming governor of New York and using the paper to promote his politics and his ideas. So, yeah, definitely a lot of that going on. And I think he actually started his paper. I thought this was interesting because I guess the other papers in New York at the time were Republican, and apparently newspapers just said what their bias was at the time. And so he specifically started his paper to be a more Democratic paper.
Okay. Interesting. I wonder if like with how much you hear about Pulitzer Prizes being the highest possible achievement for journalism, it seems a little bit odd to see him being demonized so in a Disney movie, which I found a little bit surprising. But of course, they do play him up to be this greedy capitalist, even though, based on what you just said, he's on the side of these guys. So it seems a little bit backwards.
Right. It is really interesting. He was also really well known. His paper, they called it Yellow Journalism. So his paper was the first one that was really like all about sensationalizing and making the stories sound juicy, rather, like you said early on, rather than just reporting the truth. And like Jack mentions that too, when he's like, I don't know, embellishing, saying he's not doing anything different than the journalists are doing. So yeah, it is really interesting that Pulitzer ends up, I guess they have to have a villain in to champion the newsies and make them the heroes. But yeah, it just, and that Teddy Roosevelt has to be the hero too. It is interesting. I feel like all of that doesn't really make much sense, but.
Right. Yeah. We have the government or the governor coming in right on the white horse, even though it's the corruption of government that is one of the key issues here with the boys' prison, the refuge, or what's it called?
The refuge.
Yeah. All right, Robert, I'm going to give you a head of steam here. So we've talked about a fair amount of stuff. I'm sure you got a little diatribe in you. So why don't you start talking and we will splice out some of the space here.
Okay. Well, I had a few thoughts. My primary one not being particularly interesting, but it's what's at the top of my brain right now. So this is what you're going to get. I find it a little bit interesting. It kind of reminds me of like today's fight for 15 minimum wage law kind of stuff, where these newsies are kind of, they're at the bottom end of the economic ladder and they're just basically trying to scrape by. They're, you know, entrepreneurs that are just starting out in the world. They're generally, you know, teenagers or even maybe younger. And they are learning basically how the world works. So, you know, I cut them a little bit of slack for, you know, seeing these other industries that are unionized and going, hey, we can do that too. And not understanding, you know, exactly what a right is. Like at one point, you know, the smart kid says that they've got rights and then their rights are being, you know, they're not being respected. And of course they have to be super vague about that because they don't know what the hell they're talking about. They don't go into any kind of detail. Nobody presses them, asks them a single question, like what right is being not respected? What right is Mr. Pulitzer not respecting? And then they would actually have to come up with some sort of an answer to that question. But it strikes me, because I don't know the answer to this question, I'm going to pose it to you guys, and I don't know if you guys know either. But it's also, you know, in the minimum wage debate, one of the things is, you know, companies are going to mechanize instead. They're going to replace cashiers with computers, you know, touchscreen ordering services or automated checkout places. You're going to do it yourself instead of having a cashier there to do it. In the Newsies case, I don't know how much longer they even existed, because I'm sure they were replaced eventually by the coin-operated newspaper things that still existed up into the year 2000. They may even still exist on the streets of Seattle or New York today. I don't even put in a quarter or 50 cents or a dollar and take out a paper and walk around and read that, whatever. I assume that's what they were replaced by. I don't know if for a time there, you know, they tried those out and see if they did better than the Newsies did. I'm sure they were cheaper, of course. You don't have to pay the Newsie, you know, his cut, the 40% or whatever. But it's say, you know, the papers don't sell themselves. The Newsies sell themselves, or the headlines don't sell the papers. The Newsies sell the pants, the truth. But the coin operated machines wouldn't do that. So I'm curious. I'm sure we don't know. None of us knows the history, but if you do, speak up. But I'm wondering if there was a John Henry versus the Iron Horse kind of a competition, you know, where he was doing, I forget what that, the whole thing was, but Ukraine, right? But if a newsie, you know, went up against like a coin operating machine, or just how much, you know, he outsold, if it was cost effective to sell to the newsie, or if the newsie profession just died the way of the dinosaur, because it was way more efficient to just have a machine. I don't know, but those are my thoughts right now. You guys are doing a great job. Keep up the good work. Over.
Over now, 10-4, good buddy. All right. Yeah, I don't know the history on this, but I do have a little bit of personal history in that when I was young, I had a paper route. And so I would go and deliver in the small town that we lived in. And it actually had a similar relationship that the Newsies had with Pulitzer, where they would have to buy the papers and then sell them at the cover price. And then they would keep the difference. When I was a paper delivery guy, I was probably 12 years old or something like that. And I would do the route every day. Sundays were the worst because it was the heaviest one. And sometimes I'd have to go on two different loads because the papers were so heavy and only so many would fit in the carrier. It was like this like vest thing. You had some in the front and some in the back. But one of the components of the deal was that I was also the collection agent for the monthly payments for the paper. And I would owe the paper business a certain amount for the papers themselves, and then I would keep the remainder. And so if anyone didn't pay that month, and there was always like a handful that were late or wouldn't pay, that came directly out of my end. So in that regard, it did feel like I was getting a little bit screwed, especially as a 12-year-old. I don't know how else they would have arranged it, but for me to be the one taking all the risk on the non-payers, it does seem a little bit of the short end. And then regarding the mechanization or the ability of having machines where they were coin operated, I can see that probably did become the more predominant thing. Granted, it probably didn't sell as many because they weren't enunciating like extra, read all about it. Ape person, you know, down the street eats, slips on a banana peel, dog bites man bites dog, whatever like headline they come up with. But it also probably they could have machines on every corner, and just stocking that one machine with 50 or 100 papers was probably far easier than having a bunch of newsboys running around. So I do think that their time was kind of limited anyway. I could also see them having like these little clickbait headlines being somewhat more effective at selling more papers, like per unit of time, perhaps. Abby, do you have any input on Robert's question?
Yeah, I don't know the history of the coin-operated machines either, but I would imagine. So this is kind of like a brief period in history where prosperity was increasing. So kids who were orphans, were very poor, weren't just like dying as babies, but actually have jobs and take care of themselves. Which is the one thing that I really, not the one thing, I have, this movie has this place in my heart from when I was 9 years old. But one of the things that I really appreciate about this movie is that it's not anti-child labor, or not too anti-child labor, which I think is really important because, it does show that it was the Industrial Revolution, and so people had more money, and so kids like this actually could make a living. But I imagine as wealth keeps increasing, there's not as many kids around to be newsies. They're like going to school and stuff. So that it could be, it was cheaper than the newsies, or it could be they had trouble finding kids to be newsies anymore.
All right. Yeah, that's a really good point. In fact, I think that one of the arguments for compulsory school was supported by unions because they didn't want competition from underage kids. So they wanted them to go into compulsory schooling.
That totally makes sense.
Yeah. All right. So yeah. You're bringing up a really good point. So they probably had difficulty getting enough newsies, especially after raising the price like this and upsetting a lot of them, apparently, because they were either going into compulsory schooling, or there were other opportunities available to them, or because the prosperity had increased, the standard of living had increased enough that they didn't need as many kids, like not as many kids needed to find this kind of work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Let's see. I had another really good point to bring up, but now I've totally forgotten it. Let's see. See, now I'm going to pause because my brain's not working quite right. But let's see, what else? I don't know. Robert, do you have any other points you want to make up? Because we actually are getting close to the time where we can start, after you make another point, getting into the final summary reviews and giving it a number of papes out of 10.
Well, you guys bring up an excellent point, Abby. That was fantastic about the child labor. Yeah, the idea that the wealth is increasing and that there weren't enough kids, perhaps, to fill the jobs because they were too busy being put in school or otherwise not having to seek employment. That's an excellent point. I do just want to expand on that a little bit because, like Daniel was saying, the unions were in for making child labor laws and that kind of thing. But government, without them, everything would be terrible, and that they're responsible for child labor laws and how they stamped out child labor, when in reality, like you guys were talking about, how it's the accumulation of wealth, which doesn't require, back in the day when there wasn't so much wealth, children often made up a good chunk of the family's income.
Mm-hmm.
So it was either, it wasn't a choice of, you know, hang out and whatever. It was a choice of work or starve, or work or be a child prostitute, or, you know, work in the mines, or work in some, you know, not ideal fashion, you know, work on the farm, that kind of thing. It wasn't just, hey, we're going to be kids and play around all day. It was, no, we, as a family, we don't have a lot of money. And you guys need to get to work so that we can actually have food to eat. So it wasn't a case of, you know, parents didn't love their kids back in the day. It was, we need to survive. So that's just expanding on your excellent points. I really don't have any other points to make. I've mentioned, I wouldn't mind ranting a little bit more about Roosevelt. He, when he was governor of New York, and I believe he was a governor of New York during the Spanish-American War. And he was a huge, or maybe he was in the Senate or Congress at that point. I'm not sure, one or the other. He might have been in Washington at that point. He was a huge proponent for the war because he thought that not only was war awesome, it was how the great races and the great nations became great, was by dominating and expanding their influence and power and control over the rest of the world, and showing how these darkies, and yes, he was a massive racist, he thought that these people didn't know how to, you know, govern themselves, and we needed to show them the great, wonderful American way and how great Americanism was. He was very much like that, you know, Roman idealism, like, we are so awesome and we need to project this power for the good of the heathens kind of style of human being. And he went so far, and the Spanish-American War was very, very quick. It was over very, I mean, it was kind of no muss, no fuss. The United States lost around like 2,000 guys, and the Spanish lost a massive amount of people. Cuba was devastated, but in terms of American losses, the United States was like, came out smelling like a rose, and they were like, man, this is awesome. This is just fantastic. And so I can kind of understand where Roosevelt, who actually, in a, you know, he wasn't a hypocrite. When the war broke out, he quit his job in Congress and fired up his own regiment called the Rough Riders, and famously fought in the Spanish-American War with a bunch of cowboys, literal cowboys, and athletes and other people, sharpshooters and whatnots. So he was, you know, he was actually putting himself at risk. So I'll give him that much. But he defended war up to, even through the American conquest in the Philippines, which we kind of sort of took from Spain as a result of the Spanish-American War. It was one of the kind of conquesting spoils that we took in terms of the surrender of Spain. And that war was an absolute brutal bloodbath where we were butchering the native people of the Philippines, much like, I mean, there was basically a My Lai massacre every day, where if one soldier got shot at or something, they would just burn down the entire village, murdering everybody in the whole village. You know, thousands of people just murdered. It was a brutal bloodbath that Teddy Roosevelt thought was the greatest thing in the world.
This is absolutely fantastic because it projected American power over the planet and taught everybody how awesome America was somehow, some way. He only, when his own grandson was killed in the First World War. He had, I think, 3 grandkids that fought in the First World War. When the first one got like his first combat kill, they like loved it. It was fantastic. When the second one got their first combat kill, it was fantastic. Loved it. But when the third one was shot down and killed, he supposedly would just go off to like long quiet stares into the distance, and like maybe he kind of learned his lesson, something. He has no morality of any kind. He's a horrible racist, and the fact that he is any kind of a hero in any way in this movie automatically makes this movie garbage. So for all the other reasons, absolutely trash. It is, you know, anti-capitalistic. It is, doesn't understand what a right is. It's somehow, so yeah. Anyway, we can get into final summaries and review, but that's my end rant on that aspect.
All right. Well, thank you for that. And thank you for taking the time, because it actually made me remember the thing I was going to talk about, which was about child labor. But before we get to that, just a little bit more about the Spanish-American War. This is one of those examples of journalists lying about something to get us into war. Of course, the famous Remember the Maine. And here's a little blurb about it. The USS Maine was a United States Navy ship that sank in Havana Harbor in February of 1898, contributing to the outbreak of the Spanish-American War. American newspapers engaging in yellow journalism to boost circulation claimed that the Spanish were responsible for the ship's destruction. So this is one of those false flag events. It may or may not have even happened, but it was to drive up newspaper sales with a very hot headline and, of course, light us into war, which was repeated numerous times over the course of time, including like the Gulf of Tonkin. And some argue the events on 9/11, which the anniversary is, of course, coming up right soon here. And then related to, you know, honestly, Abby, we should have done this last week in the lead up to Labor Day, because and this sort of ties into the sweatshop stuff. There's a Tom Woods email. He sends this one out almost every year related to Labor Day, because his father was a Teamster for 15 years and he grew up in a working class household. And this is Tom Woods here. It says, I don't believe the propaganda for a second. The quote, the weekend brought to you by labor unions, end quote, reads the bumper sticker. I see. So those third world countries looking to escape poverty and enjoy additional leisure just need some labor unions. What's the point of foreign aid then? Why don't we just save ourselves all that money and just tell these countries to unionize instead? Until society grows wealthy enough, all the labor unions in the world can't make it possible to take 2 days off a week from work. Can you imagine if a primitive economy of 300 years ago, people agitating for a shorter work week, people would have thought you're insane. With little capital and with most goods produced by hand, it takes all the labor power of all the hours that you can spare just to make life barely livable. And that's why people worked long hours in terrible conditions in the past, and why they do so in the third world today. Not because short men with white mustaches and a monocle take delight in oppressing them. What emancipated people from these dehumanizing conditions were capital goods and the market economy. With workers vastly more productive than before, thanks to the assistance of machines, physical output was multiplied in quantity and quality many, many times over. This greater abundance put downward pressure on prices relative to wage rates, and people's standards of living rose. Their paychecks could buy more stuff now because there was vastly more stuff in existence. And at that time, they began to opt for more leisure and more pleasant working conditions rather than more cash. And if you ask people who work in sweatshops today if they'd prefer to, one, have more pleasant conditions or fewer working hours, but they would take home less money, they overwhelmingly say no. Professor Ben Powell of Texas Tech University actually bothered to ask them. And 90+% of them said that they would rather have the money from the additional work rather than what the Western do-gooders thought that they should want. Meanwhile, American workers had the eight-hour workday well before their much more heavily unionized counterparts in Europe did, and they earned higher wages. Unionism never accounted for more than a third of the American labor force, and that was at its height. So whatever your kids' teachers are crediting unions for, just roll your eyes. So that was the point I wanted to make earlier when I was when my brain wasn't working. Apparently, my brain was on union hours, something like that. But I'll post this link to the Tom Woods email. It's a really good one, and some of Ben Powell's work, where he actually goes into discussing sweatshops and what are the alternatives that people who are working those conditions would have if those sweatshops were shut down or if wages were increased to the point where they weren't as employable, which back to one of Robert's earlier points, the higher the wages of a class of workers, the more incentive it is for those who employ them to replace them with automation or other ways to economize relative to what the wages would have otherwise been. So, Abby, I know that I just read a lot of stuff. I'm sure it was really interesting for the audience. But do you have any other points that you want to bring up before we get into final summary review and give a rate on a number of papes out of 10 on this one?
Yeah, I wanted to say I don't necessarily see this movie as anti-capitalistic. I know the Newsies definitely don't understand what a right is. But like you said, they are children, so we can maybe forgive them for that. And some of them don't even have parents to teach them what their rights are. But basically, like, yes, unions are awful, but mostly that's because they are taking money from people to go and lobby for government to make certain laws. So what the Newsies formed wasn't so much that kind of a union, but, you know, all the newspapers were colluding together to raise their prices together so that there wouldn't be competition. And so the Newsies just colluded together too to say that they weren't going to buy papers at that price. So I think that's kind of pro-capitalistic. Like, they were all entrepreneurs and business for themselves, and they were just voluntarily associating together. They did have the violence against the scabs, but then they realized the error of their ways and stopped the violence. There's a line that Pulitzer says when he's trying to, like, bribe Jack, where he says, anyone who doesn't act in his own self-interest is a fool. And then Jack is like, or no, Davy says, well, then what does that make you? Because you're losing all this money while we're not outselling your papes. So I think that's a good pro-capitalism point that the movie ends on. And that's what convinces Pulitzer to negotiate with the Newsies to get them a better deal on the papes while still the newspaper making money. And I think it's a good pro-capitalism ending to the movie. If you ignore the Teddy Roosevelt part.
All right. So if we ignore Teddy Roosevelt, if we ignore the violence, if we ignore the property destruction, and we ignore the theft of the use of the press, ink, and paper to make the competing paper, then okay. Yeah. Now, Walter Block had it was either an article or a lecture where he was talking about he was trying to find a totally voluntary union, and he found one that claimed to be such. I think in Canada. And so he reached out to them and was like, so you guys claim to be this totally, you know, voluntary union. And I think that their perspective was that, I guess, people could choose to join or not join and still have the job or something like that. And I'm in support of workers banding together so that they have more bargaining power in the respect of, hey, if we all quit, then you're going to have to rehire and retrain and all that stuff. But if they're going to try to prevent other people from taking those jobs, that goes over the line. Yeah. But back to the Walter Block story, he asked them a series of questions. And one of the questions was, do you support pro-union legislation enforced by government against employers? And they said, yes. And he said, ah, then you're not truly a voluntary union because you're supporting this force of violence of the state against the employer to get what you want. And so that's where I draw the line is, They're not like beating up people like the Newsies were, at least initially in this, but they are basically outsourcing the violence to the state apparatus to enforce these impositions and regulations upon the companies that employ them. And so in that regard, they are not actually, you know, truly nonviolent or voluntary.
Right. And yeah, I'm sure if you ask the Newsies if they would want the government to enforce laws for them, that they would say yes. They were not voluntarists, unfortunately. I also think it's interesting because Davy, the the most pro-union line that irritates me in the movie is when Davy says, oh yeah, my dad got hurt, and so he didn't have a union to fight for him, so the factory just fired him. Which it's like, but but he doesn't appreciate that all of his siblings can just go out and easily get jobs and provide for the family and make all this money. And I also appreciate the relationship with Jack, where he's kind of like apprenticing them and they work out a deal where he gets part of their earnings and stuff like that. And I think, gosh, those kids were probably learning so much more than my kids learn in school every day, being running their own business and negotiating things like that, and going and having to talk to Pulitzer and printing their own newspaper, all kinds of stuff. Also, Jack was staying in the room with the printing press. So, I mean, it could have been kind of implied that he could use whatever was in that room. So
it's squatter's rights.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, well, all right, you're giving me a couple of like silver linings in this, you know, and you're right. I do like the agreement that he had with Davy initially, when he's like, no, you don't want just 20 papes, you need 50 or 100, because you got to like really go out there and push these things. So he was doing like an apprenticeship mentorship kind of thing to mm-hmm. take him under his wing and make him more effective, and then getting a benefit out of that. So that was yeah. a voluntary relationship that I thought was beneficial to both parties. And so what do we call that? Mutually beneficial exchange. That's where both parties benefit. And that's the essence of the free market.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit, a few yeah. nuggets in there. Okay. All right. So Robert, if you got a head of steam, why don't you give us your final summary and review? And then how many papes are you peddling on that street corner?
Oh, it looks like you're going to me. I did not hear that. Okay. Excellent. So, Newsies, I appreciate that this movie was brought to my attention. It's been a fun discussion, as much I've enjoyed listening to you guys talk. I feel like I've learned of something today. This is fantastic. It's, you know, it feels like a Disney studio movie. It feels like one of those movies that they made back in the 70s and the 80s, and they just kind of pumped them out. You know, I'm sure it was completely filmed on like the back lot at, you know, wherever. The what do they call them? Those paintings, the matte paintings that make it look like they're in a different place. It looks okay. It doesn't look great even for the time at which this was made, though. It definitely feels like a lower budget kind of a project, a thing that, you know, I guess they adapted it from a play, right? So for what it is, it's decent. You know, the setting, though, I think is its best quality. We don't get a lot of these movies, and I really love this time period. There's another movie like Gangs of New York, which isn't the greatest movie, but I really enjoy that kind of urban setting. I even liked Moulin Rouge, but I really enjoyed that setting of just that early American and urban life, and how it actually went down. And of course, all these movies aren't, it's almost kind of like going to another world. And that's a fun thing for me. It's history, and it's foreign at the same, and it's familiar all at the same time. So I enjoy that kind of thing. The plot of the film itself, it is, and Abby's right, you give the kids some slack, because there are grown ass adults who do just as stupid shit, who think that unions are awesome and, you know, are responsible for all this stuff, and think that, you know, having government, you know, protect your rights or bringing in the force of the law to, you know, enforce this or that dictate is fantastic, as long as it benefits them. So I can't fault it too much, but for all the reasons that we've already mentioned, I can't recommend this film. I don't think it's
something that I will ever go back to. I do appreciate that Abby brought this to our attention and that we had this conversation. I think this has been a fun episode. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to really like interject due to this crappy connection, unfortunately. But we should be better next week, back into form. But for me, this gets 3.5 papes out of 10. It's just not good enough. It doesn't have the right messaging. It really doesn't. The hero, because of the violence that they're using, because somehow they were wronged when the paper was increased in price, as if that's a violation of their rights, that just perpetuates people not understanding what the hell a right is. And that just dumbs down humanity. I can't in good conscience recommend a film that does that. 3.5 papes out of 10, Daniel.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Robert. And I agree with a lot of your sentiments. I think it's well done. And Christian Bale stands out. I thought that Robert Duvall standed out. He's a great actor. Bill Pullman's performance was pretty good. But you're right. I think that the message in this is definitely slanted in one direction. And I think it is borderline propaganda, especially with the intended target audience of being kids. You're basically indoctrinating them into misunderstanding what rights are and misunderstanding the place of, the free market relationships and voluntary relationship that would be more appropriate for people to learn about when they're kids. So while it's well done, I also can't really recommend that this be shown to get the kids. And Abby, I know that you liked this when it came out and when you were a kid, and I can see that appeal. You know, you've got these young boys singing and dancing and whatnot. So I'm sure it was fun to watch with your girlfriends on sleepovers and pillow fights and all of that. But this isn't a movie I would show my kids. I think that I would show it to them after they've kind of been exposed or quote unquote inoculated against this type of propaganda. You know, to where they have an awareness of what voluntary relationships are in the free market and the origins of unions and what they actually do. And seeing these portrayals of violence that are sort of like candy coated in this story, when it really is an evil thing that they're doing, you know, committing violent acts against people, destroying property. I guess today's news media headlines would say it's mostly peaceful, violent, or what was the term? Soaking, mostly peaceful soaking. So similarly, I'm going to give it a pretty low score, but I will, you know what? I'm going to raise the price of the papes. I'm Pulitzer. I'm going to give it 4 papes out of 10. So Abby, we'll go to you for your final summary review and your number of papes out of 10. You could definitely give it a higher score. I don't want to like have pressured you to diminish your liking of this film.
No, yeah. So I would say my kids know they can't get through any movie without me lecturing them about economics. So that might be the difference. Why I don't mind kids watching this movie. I love it again from my childhood. And I feel like it's a thing with like my friends this age. Like we can sing the songs together. I think the songs are great. I like the dancing and the backflips, and I just think it's really cute. And also, yeah, the time period and that it's historical, it's a true story. Again, I think it doesn't make a lot of sense who they decided were the villains and the heroes and why they brought Teddy Roosevelt in at the end. It is a little bit cheesy, but yeah, Christian Bale is great. So I guess I know I'm biased just because I've known this movie forever and I'll go around singing the songs all the time. But I would give it 6.5 papes and seize the day.
All right. Yeah. Okay. You know what? I can totally see that score. It's not like super high, but it has that nostalgia factor.
Yeah.
And I like the idea that you'd present this to your kids and then have the discussion on, okay, when they did this, that was actually wrong, and here's why. Yep. So I think it's kind of a learning moment, sort of like how we had a little bit of learning on this on this conversation. So I do appreciate you bringing this movie to our attention. It's not one that I would have watched otherwise, except for maybe by accident, just because, you know, it's on Disney and, oh, it must be kid friendly or whatever. So in a way, actually, I lucked out in having seen this now and knowing that I might want to be cautious in showing this to my kids.
Yeah. And I will also say that it wasn't a play that was made into a movie. It was a movie that is now made into a play. And the theater version is also on Disney Plus, and it's also really good.
Well, I don't think
you're into musical theater.
I don't think we're going to get Robert to watch that one. I don't know about that. But what I will get him to watch is a documentary film for next week about wine called Red Obsession, which is going to be with our returning guest, Jonathan Reed. He has been on for a number of films in the past. He's a bit of a film buff, and we always have really good discussions with him. So this one is called Red Obsession, and it is available on Canopy, which is where I'm going to watch it, which is the socialist of streaming services, because I get it through the public library system. So that's where I'm going to end up watching that one. So Robert, Red Obsession, I'm not sure where you can see it, but maybe you can get a library membership and get access to this system called Canopy that starts with a K.
Okay. Red Obsession. Fantastic. We'll check it out.
All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for this episode of Last Nighters. You can find us at lastnighters.com/194 for the show notes and more for this one. We're going to have a couple of things listed on here. Not only the Tom Woods email and the Remember the Main stuff and Rothbard lectures about our friend Teddy Roosevelt, but also a link to Abby's contributing website and podcast, The Bad Roman Project, and that can be found at thebadroman.com. The word the is important in that URL, so thebadroman.com, and I think I can get that scrolling along the bottom here again. Oh, look at that. See, sometimes the technology does work out for us. So Abby, any final words for our audience before we get into some Kathleen Turner Overdrive, which is bonus content available for our Patreon supporters at lastnighters.com/Patreon?
I don't think so.
All right. Well, this has been a lot of fun, and I appreciate you being our guest, and we'd love to have you back sometime in the future. Hopefully it'll be a time when Robert has a better connection, so there isn't a 5 to 10 second delay in his responding, and he'll be able to interject whenever the mood strikes, which is how we're usually want to do on this podcast. But, you know, we've made do with some of the technological challenges that I foisted upon myself and Robert had due to his location constraints on this one. But this has been a lot of fun, and I'd like to have you on again soon.
Yeah, I'd like that too. Thanks for having me on.
All right, well, that's going to do it for this episode of Last Nighters. You can find it at lastnighters.com/194, and we'll see you guys next week with Jonathan Reed for Red Obsession. And with that, good night from Last Night, everyone. Peace out. All right, just a few more minutes extra on the Actual Anarchy podcast. You can find the show notes and more for this at actualanarchy.com/251. And I usually try to save a question for the end here. Robert, you had originally mentioned that you felt like the romance was tacked on, and I heartily agree. It seemed as if there was almost no chemistry. There was no lead up to the final kiss at the end and him being outside of her bedroom window. I don't know why that was in there. I guess maybe it was for the fangirls, Abby, when you were young and watching this, the boys singing and dancing, they just had to have that little bit of romance scene in it. Because it didn't seem to really fit into the movie.
I think it's to give him more of a reason to not go to Santa Fe after all. But I agree. It feels very forced and awkward. Also, the rooftop scene when he was like, nobody's ever cared if I stayed or went before, do you care? And she just laughs at him, and you're kind of like, what a monster, what's wrong with this girl?
All right, Robert, let's get your input on this, and then I have one other question.
Yeah, the romance I didn't buy for a second. I didn't even understand why it was in there if they were just going to half-ass it. Like, the movie is like two-thirds of the way over before they even almost, I mean, he meets the sister maybe about a third of the way in, 40% of the way in, but it's just that one dinner. And then it isn't until like about 2/3 or almost 3/4 of the way in where they start, you know, moving into, oh, okay, these people are getting to interact and talk and they like each other. I thought it was way too late. If you're going to have a romance like that, you need to start it off early and have it progress throughout the movie and intersperse, you know, here's a little scene with them here. Here's a reason why they like each other here. And, you know, and have it progress throughout the movie, not just like go, okay, these two characters exist. This is the an attractive woman that is his age. So, of course, they're going to fall in love. And then they plow forward and have this awkward kiss at the end. It just, yeah, I didn't buy it for a second. I thought it was completely unnecessary. It just felt awkward and bad. Like the producers or the, you know, people just tacked on because they thought they needed it or something like that. It was bad. It was just bad.
Yeah. There was that one scene where he came to her aid when she was being assaulted by the two cronies from the newspaper. But I still don't think that was enough to kind of build this relationship on, at least in the story as presented. But it's a musical. It's meant for the young girls at the time back in 92. So I'll give it a little bit of a pass on that. There was one other thing that was a little bit, I think, of a plot hole. And that was when Bale was sent back to the refuge. And I think Davey helped him escape from that meeting with Pulitzer at the mansion. And he tells Davey, you know, just leave me alone, run away, you know, get away from me. And it's not clear, at least in the movie to me, it wasn't clear that then Bale was giving himself up and going back into the refuge, but then all of a sudden he's back at the refuge. And I just thought that that was just not made abundantly clear. Maybe I'm stupid, but it really seemed like if Christian Bale wanted to stay at the refuge and not escape, why would he run with Davey? So it just felt a little bit missed there. What's your take, Abby? And then we'll get Robert's take, and then we can wind down and get in some Kathleen Turner overdrive.
Yeah, I agree. That part's a little bit awkward. I don't know. I guess so that they could have kind of a conflict there and show his struggle with should he go with Davey? Should he stay at the refuge? And then he decides to stay. One other thing, I think the thing that bothers me the most about the movie is the Meta, the like burlesque lady. It seems a little bit pedophile-y. Just to throw that out there.
Yeah, we didn't even bring her up, but yeah, that was kind of weirdly important in the movie for some reason. Like all the boys were so excited about her. So Robert, final tirade out of you related to this potentially missed, miscommunicated scene and Meta, the burlesque lady.
I wasn't sure what the movie was trying to do with that Meta situation. It seemed a little bit on the, pedophilia style. Like she was obviously way too old for these kids. She seemed to treat Bale as kind of a second son, kind of whatever, friend of, you know, the father. So she, you know, took care of the kid kind of in a way. But I don't know, the way she performed for the kids, the newsies, I mean, it wasn't her act wasn't overtly sexual. But that's probably because Disney's toning things down for a kid's movie. Back in the day, I mean, these burlesque dancers, they got a little bit, quite a bit more risque than was projected in, or was shown in this film. Anyway, the scene you were talking about where Bale's like feeling confused and he's been, you know, offered this money by Pulitzer, it did seem a little bit awkward. And there were times in this film where I felt like scenes were missing because things just kind of jumped around a little bit too much. But in this one, I kind of gave it a pass because he runs off with what Eric, I guess his name is, because he's not really sure what to do. And his friend is there and he grabs him and he's like, yeah, okay, sure. He's still making up his mind. He's been given this big offer. And, you know, at first he decides to take it. And then he's like, I guess not, when he runs into those goons and whatnot. I give it a little bit of a pass because it's just, you know, it's the first time in his whole life where he's actually had folding money to walk around with that he could actually buy things with.
And he's not just being a gutter rat, you know, Aladdin kid on the streets of Agrabah. So it's not the best movie in the world. The storytelling isn't fantastic. There are you know, jumps and cuts that if we really wanted to get into it and go over it with a fine-tooth comb, I'm sure we could nitpick a whole lot more. I don't think this is a Shakespeare, but it was watchable. It held my interest. I only had to pause it and restart it, you know, like five or six times, which is pretty good for a Disney movie of this this caliber and this time. So, you know, there you go. That's my final thoughts on Newsies, everybody.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Robert. And Abby, thanks again for bringing this one up. The next time that we have you on, we will have much wittier and quicker banter because Robert won't be on this 5 or 10 second delay that he has tonight. But I think that we made it work, you know, and I'll cut some of those little sections out on the final audio recording. But just remind people where they can find the project you work on. I got it scrolling down here at the bottom, and then I will get in some Kathleen Turner Overdrive.
Yeah, so you can find us at thebadroman.com or the Bad Roman podcast is on all the podcatchers. You can find us there.
All right, very good. And I'm glad to have learned that you were a listener prior to the Dennis Foster appearances, and it just so happened to be coincidental.
Yeah.
So that makes me feel even better. Like we're actually, you know, we earned it on our own merits a little
you
bit.
You totally did. He was just my excuse to reach out. So.
All right, perfect. Well, thanks again. And we'll be back next week with Jonathan Reed for Red Obsession. And until then, I want to just say maximum freedom, everyone. And peace out. Have a good night.
Chipmunks. Chipmunk. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do 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 do.